Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Aaron, the producer of the Shattering Myths show, brought this news item to my attention yesterday. The dateline is Opeka, Kansas, and a great heartland of America. The news source is the Associated Press. It reads, "The Reverend Fred Phelps Sr., the fiery founder of a small Kansas church, who led outrageous and hate-filled protests that blamed almost everything, including the deaths of AIDS victims and U.S. soldiers, on America's tolerance for gay people, has died. He was 84. Oh boy, does he ever now know that he was wrong. But imagine how stupid you'd have to be. I mean, just utterly moronic you'd have to be. To think that that God and his God, the Christian God, was deliberately targeting American soldiers because the U.S. government was tolerant of gay people. So, God is peering into the bedrooms of homosexuals in America. And he is saying, oh boy, don't like that stuff. So, what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to arrange for American soldiers to walk into the paths of IEDs. Not by hold them, hold their hand, walk them right to the IEDs and make them go boom. I'll put Islamic terrorists right in their gun sights. That's what I'm going to do. What a great plan. Yep, am I a great God or what? Yeah, that's how I'm going to communicate to people, is that I'm going to micromanage events so that I kill people who have nothing to do with a particular issue, and that'll really show people what I'm all about. And yet that's the God of Reverend Fred Phelps. But the world is better off with that man dead. Now, I always ask fundamentalist Christians, and he was a Baptist, like Jerry Falwell, who for years was a good friend of mine. I always ask them, you know, if your fixation here on homosexuality, if it's such a big deal to God, you know, if it's the ultimate litmus test for God as to whether or not he's going to judge and condemn a nation or bless a nation, as you claim, why didn't homosexuality make his top 10 list? It's not there. You know, I always just got blank stares from them. I see, you know, if homosexuality was really the big deal that really irked God, then can you tell me why it's adultery, not homosexuality, that did make the top 10 list? Why it's observing the Shabbat that made the top 10 list? Why it's referring to Yahweh as Yahweh and by no other name that made the top 10 list? That not having any religious icons or idols, not being religious, made the top 10 list, and homosexuality didn't? Methinks that the fixation on homosexuality is a derivative of the Christian religion and not a result of God's instructions. Now, throughout his life, Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, a small congregation made up almost entirely of his extended family, tested the boundaries of free speech, violating accepted societal standards for decency in their unapologetic assault on gays and lesbians. In the process, some believe he even helped the gay cause and gay rights by serving as such a provocative symbol of intolerance. I agree. You know, when you bomb an abortion clinic, you encourage those who would be pro-choice. You advance their cause because you show that those who are opposed to them are murderous idiots. When you are this out of touch with reality, and your opposition to homosexuality, that you go and you blame the deaths of an American soldier on the fact that the country is pro-gay rights, you are so moronic, so disgusting, so just lost, so utterly out of touch with reality, that since you represent the opposition, all the opposition has to say, you want to be like that guy? You want to be on the same side as that idiot? They do an enormous amount of good for bad by being so bad. You know, I realized that at a Christian funeral, when the pastor or priest is telling the living that God called the dearly departed home because he wanted them, and that dearly departed is waiting for them in heaven, and they will be reunited with their loved one in heaven, that everything he's saying is a lie. And while it would be good for those in those pews to hear the truth and to have the lie refuted, the place to do it is not during the funeral. You're not going to find a single receptive person during the funeral. All you're going to do is aggravate everyone. Why do that? And yet that was this man's strategy. We have Nick on the line, who's calling in from Wisconsin. Nick is a long-term listener to the program and has asked many questions and made many statements over the year or so we've been doing this that has greatly added to the content of the program. So it's always my pleasure to welcome Nick. How are you, my friend?
Good morning. I'm good. So, few questions again.
Okay.
Where in Torah does it say about how the Yah created the universe?
Mm-hmm.
Where should I look for it?
Oh, okay. The explanation of how, when, and the order of his creation is found in the opening lines of the Torah in Bereshith, which is in Genesis, and you'll find it in Genesis 1 and 2, and it details Yahweh's creative endeavor. If you'd like to read it translated in an amplified way, and then compared to what we know scientifically, if you go to yadayah.com, yadayah.com, the first volume of the seven volumes of Yada Yah walk you through most everything that God revealed to us regarding creation. And one of the advantages of the Yada Yah presentation of Genesis 1 and 2, Nick, is that I apply relativity to the presentation of the timeline of creation, where I use the microwave radiation that is still emanating out of the Big Bang to demonstrate that 6 24-hour days from the perspective of the Creator at creation is identical to 14 billion years of time from our perspective here on Earth looking back because of the rate that time flows in various circumstances.
Okay, well, I only wanted to know where, why, because I suppose someone just pulling my tongue, and I have to start conversations with the Muslims again, and,
okay.
You know, I'm probably in that point where you were once, where
yes.
You were kept arguing with them until you just lost the interest in, so
right.
For some reason I just...
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I lost interest in arguing with Muslims a long time ago. And Nick, you are correct in this regard. When I posted Tea with Terrorists and Prophet of Doom online after publishing both books, I received tens of thousands of letters from Muslims, and they varied from most of the Muslims who wrote me were just savages. You know, they were foul-mouthed, and they were threatening to kill me for insulting their religion. And I would still write them back and say, how could I be insulting your religion when I've quoted from every source that forms the basis of your religion, and I've taken the four earliest sources of Islam, put them in chronological order, set them in the context of Muhammad's life, and reordered the Quran based upon the biographical information that we have on Muhammad. How can that insult your religion since I'm citing your religion? Well, of course, they didn't have any response to that. Mm-hmm. About 20% of the letters I got were from less foul-mouthed individuals, less violent individuals who would claim one argument or another, you know, that Islam is the fastest growing religion, therefore it must be true. And I'd respond to that and say, yeah, that isn't actually true, and popularity has never been a litmus test for truth. And we go through why Islam is actually growing, because if you cease to be a Muslim in an Islamic country, they kill you. You know, then they would say, you know, you've taken something out of context, you've misquoted it, you don't know Arabic, therefore you have no business doing this. And I'd write them back and say, well, yeah, but the Quran is actually written in Hebrew. Almost every important word in the Quran is Hebrew. The alphabet that is used to write the Quran is Hebrew. You know, knowing Hebrew is a huge advantage. Beyond this, you're trying to tell me that your God was so incompetent that he was unable to communicate in any language other than one of the more recent languages that man has conceived. You know, written Arabic didn't even exist until the 7th century. And you know, then they'll say, "What, you misquoted something?" So we'll go through and we'll cite the various translations of the Quran and show that no, it's actually I quoted it accurately. But after a while, I just got tired of it. Though, I mean, after you've dealt with 10,000 of these, you know, you long reach the point where you realize that they're just regurgitating the same arguments and that no one bothers to listen.
Well, there's one who's 19 years old, and I want to tell him where in Torah it says about beginning and how the universe was created, because he's so mesmerized with the Quran and how it told him.
Yeah, in fact, Nick, if you can hang on, I will speak directly to the Islamic creation accounts, since he's mesmerized by them. We'll be back in a moment. Henry Misra having a conversation with Nick, who has been dragged headlong back into a debate with a Muslim, and his heart has caused him to be willing to engage because primarily, I would assume, the age of the young person.
He's 19 years old. He's 19 years old. How not? I mean, maybe I could save him. I don't know.
Yeah. The reason you know and I know that you're not going to be able to reach them, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. I mean, I knew that in writing
young,
Prophet.
Maybe he's not that, you know, much into it.
Yeah, if the individual is really enthusiastic about the Quran's depiction of creation, then they're way too irrational to reach. But maybe you
he
will
is the
find
one
that
who asked me where in the Torah it says about the
okay. All right. Let me just tell you a little bit about the Quran's depiction of creation. There are 20 completely different creation accounts found in the Quran. Now, in the Torah, you're going to find the creation account at the place that you would expect it. It's the first thing that God did, so it's the first thing that he speaks of. So it's the opening line of the Torah begins with Yahweh creating the spiritual realm and the material realm, the heavens and the earth. That's the opening line of the Torah. That ain't the opening line of the Quran. In fact, you won't find any reference to creation until you get deep into the Quran, and then you'll find it just spattered here and there with no sense of context or chronology. But the very fact, Nick, that there are 20 completely different creation accounts in the Quran proves that the Quran is unworthy. Internal contradiction is a guarantee, absolute proof. Okay. Anyway, what I was telling Nick is that eternal contradiction is is absolute guaranteed proof that something is not reliable. And there are so many internal contradictions in the Quran. The Quran actually has a verse that explains how to deal with the internal contradictions, which is called the law of abrogation, where that statement which is contradicted by the Islamic God is thrown into oblivion, and replacement statement which contradicts it then goes into effect. Now, of course, if you're eternal, if you're God, if you know all of time, over the period of the 10 years that you allegedly revealed your Quran, there is a 0% possibility that things would change on any important issue, much less change relative to creation. So there really is no justification whatsoever. And just by pointing out that not only are all of the Quran's depiction of creation false, they're all in conflict with one another. You know, the Quran's most repeated contradiction or creation theme is that man was created from clotted blood. And clotted blood is dead blood. And this idea that you're going to create an individual from blood is just utter and complete nonsense. You know, go try it sometime. Then the second most repetitive rant on how humankind was created is that we were created from stinking slime, from mud. And that the fact that mud comes in different colors, you can find white mud, brown mud, and red mud, explains why people have different colors, why the races have different colored skin, according to the Quran. So you're dealing with something that is so obviously untrue, so just foolish, that you ought to be able to Nick, in this particular case, undermine this 19-year-old individual's enthusiasm for the Quran and Islam just by pointing out the contradictions in the Islamic creation accounts and the utter foolishness of them. Now, one of the weaknesses of the Quran is every claim that the Quran makes scientifically is untrue. Now, it has the sun orbiting as opposed to the earth orbiting around the sun. It has the sun and the moon engaged in a race in their orbits. In the hadith explanations and confirmed in the Quran, it has the sun riding in a chariot like it was supposed to do in all of the pagan religions of yesteryear. It has Alexander the Great going on an extraterrestrial mission and finding extraterrestrials that are living in the region around the sun that Alexander the Great, according to the Quran, goes and preaches to. Of course, he fails. The Quran even has the sun going to bed at night in a muddy spring. It is so absurd, so obviously false. You ought to be able to win. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Nick, who's called in from Wisconsin, about directing his young person, 19-year-old, to where the Torah presents its creation account. And Nick, one of the things that would be interesting to present after you tell him the answer to his question and then let him know how absurdly laughable and contradictory the Quran's many creation accounts are, none of one of which is even remotely accurate, is to say, you know, that the Quran's primary claim for credibility is, according to Allah, that it confirms the Torah. And yet in the Torah's presentation of creation, not only is it entirely different than any one of the Quran's presentations of creation, on the seventh day, Yahweh, to establish his Shabbat, rested. And in Islam, it's very clear that Allah did not rest. So how is it possible that the Quran's claim for credibility is that it confirms the Torah could be true. If it contradicts the Torah on creation and every other aspect of its presentation.
I have a different strategy on how to convert them. I mean, you know, and I know that it hurts them when you point out those things, that it hurts to know that what you believe into are nothing but a lie. So what you do is you ask them to read the Torah, because they say that the Torah was Torah is the God creation. That's what they say, right? Allah created Torah.
Yeah.
And
right.
So therefore, what I just ask him is, if Torah were written by Allah, please read it. And that's
right.
All I'm asking him, and I'm directing
right.
him into the places, into where
right.
where to read and what, because there is right now I just told him, go read what does it say about Ishmael, and that's what
correct.
what Muhammad calls himself. He calls himself
correct.
Ishmael. Go read what it
right.
says about him.
Right.
So that's my strategy.
Yeah.
And
of course, as you know, what God said about Ishmael is two things that would cause great trauma for a Muslim. One is that when Abraham presented Ishmael as the heir to the covenant, you know, Abraham said, "Hey, God, you know, I don't have a kid, but I do have this kid, Ishmael. I don't have one through Sarah, but I do have one through Ishmael. Would you consider Ishmael as a participant in the covenant?" And God said, "Absolutely not, under no circumstances." And then he banished him. And then the second thing is, because Muhammad does claim to be a descendant of Ishmael, he claims that the covenant's promises came through Ishmael and that Muslims are descendants of Ishmael. In that same book, speaking of Ishmael's descendants, Yahweh's messenger says that they will be wild asses of men. They will live, their hands will be raised against their brothers, their brothers' hands will be raised against them, and they will live in hostility with the whole world.
I heard it all, I remember it all, and I hope he will read it to see for himself what the Torah says. Now, I as long as I enjoy conversation with you about the Muslims and how stupid they are and stuff, I want to say something about, I want to talk about my feelings. I want to be,
okay, sure, please.
For one. So the Torah is what I'm thinking about Torah.
Mm-hmm.
While Yahweh mm-hmm. or is it Yahweh? Yahweh or Yahweh?
The most accurate pronunciation that we can have of Yod He Wah He is Yahweh. The Y is pronounced just as it is in English and in most languages. The two Hays are pronounced Ah. It's a vowel in Hebrew, and the W or Wa in Hebrew is pronounced like the English O. So it'd be Yahweh.
Okay. So anyway, while I see that there is no way I can find any lie in the Torah, and mm-hmm. and I see that the Yahweh is a true God, and
mm-hmm.
all of his, you know, predictions happen, and,
mm-hmm.
and most likely they're not most likely, but probably not even probably, but
yeah.
for sure will happen.
Right.
Whatever didn't happen yet.
Yes.
What I feel like. He's not saying all truth. It's I feel like I receive only half of the, not the half, but not all truth are being told to me about.
Okay. Not the whole truth.
About
okay.
other side. There's no. I mean, just for example, you know, you said when he asked, "Who are you?" The guy who was talking to Yahweh.
Moshe?
Moshe? Okay, Moshe.
Yeah, Moses.
He said,
Moshe.
He said, "I am, I were, and I will be." The question is, where did you come from? Where is say. And if he doesn't have a beginning, I suppose that I'm sorry for the bad connection. I'll let you talk. Oh, well, there you go.
Oh, okay, it went away. Okay, so first of all, let me address what you've said thus far. There's a difference between not telling the whole truth and not telling everything that's true. In a court of law, you can be considered deceptive if you don't tell the whole truth. But God is not in a position where he can tell us everything that is true, because we don't have the capacity to understand much of what he would have to say. So while everything God tells us is true, which you've acknowledged, he hasn't told us everything that is true, because much of what he would have to say would not only be well beyond our capacity to understand today, it was infinitely beyond our capacity to understand several thousand years ago. So
Moshe didn't understand much either, but he
correct.
He just tried me, I suppose, or what?
Yeah, correct. That's exactly it. God, in fact, even with Abraham, God approached him and said, I'm not going to tell you everything that I know, and I'm not going to try to impress you here. But what I want you to do is I want you to consider following my guidance, my advice. And if you choose to engage with me, if you choose to come to know me, and you choose to engage based upon what the instructions that I'm providing, I'm going to do a lot of really wonderful things with you, through you, for you. So it's basically, try it. Try me. Come to get to know me. See what you think. And that is his approach. So now you get to the first point that you made, is that God's answer, when Moshe asked God, he said, the children of Israel that you're sending me back to, the first thing they're going to ask me is, who is this God that is sending me to them? That's the first thing they're going to ask. And so God's opening statement was to say, I am who I am. I am, I was, I will be who I am. That's who I am. I'm God. I am who I am. I've always been who I am. And he used the Hebrew word Haya to explain his nature. Haya is the Hebrew word for exists. It means I was, I am, I will be, I exist. And what he's saying is, I'm real. Then he said, tell them that Yahweh has sent you to them. He gave his specific name and then told him that Yahweh is the only name that he wishes to be known as. Now that does not answer your question, and God does not answer the question, because I don't think the question has an answer that from our perspective of where did God come from?
When he says that if you don't know him, or if you didn't go through all those, I'm not sure.
Oh, you don't know the Mikra are the invitations, seven invitations each year to meet with him?
And you don't do the cutting of your foreskin.
Right, circumcision, which circumcision, is the fifth requirement of the covenant.
Well, in the shirt, if you don't do those five requirements, he requires, then you're not part of his family, and therefore, when you're done here, you die. Your soul dies, and your body dies. Well, it does not make sense to me, because when you die, I think that I'm just not going to be able to join his family, but the soul, it's just dead to him. It's not dead. That's okay. What my
feeling. Yeah, all right. What God speaks of us having a physical body, which we all know decays over time, and all physical bodies die, from dust to dust. So there's no dispute that that is the case. There is no dispute scientifically that the departure of one's soul from the body is the explanation of death. Matter of fact, in Hebrew, the Hebrew word for soul, nefesh, is also the Hebrew word for breath. When we start breathing, we're dead. And so there's no question that the physical body without a soul is dead, whether it's an animal body, because God says all animals have a nefesh soul, or it is a human body. The moment the soul has departed the body, that physical body is dead. Now, your issue is, then what happens to the soul? And God presents three eventualities, three possibilities for human souls. One of the three is that our souls are brought into, adopted into His family by engaging upon, acting upon the five conditions of the covenant. And we become part of His family, and our soul, now surrounded by His spirit, lives forever with God and gets to enjoy an eternity of discovery with Him. And then there is eternal separation from Him, where the soul continues but estranged from Him. We'll continue this discussion in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We're having a discussion with Nick about the disposition of a soul. Mind you that when you talk about souls, you have to recognize that all animals have souls. Animals would include everything from insects to garden slugs to mammals, and which includes humans. And so the disposition of a soul is an indication of death. The soul is the aspect of our nature that supplies our unique personality, and it also enables us to observe and respond to our environment. Now, what God says about the soul, Nick, is that there are three eventualities for a soul. That doesn't mean that there aren't more, but He tells us about three. One of those is that the souls who have engaged upon the terms and conditions of the covenant and have answered His invitations to meet with Him, that they are eternally part of His family and they spend all time in His company. There is another group that have deliberately misled others, either through religion or through politics, and they are eternally separated from them, which means that those souls continue to live on. And they are eternally incarcerated in what appears to be a black hole. We're going to get to a prophecy that describes the nature of this incarceration over the next few weeks in Isaiah 18. So that's the opportunity. Soul lives on, but estranged from, separated from God. Now, there is a third group of souls, and this seems to be the vast majority of souls, that just as their physical bodies die, that person's consciousness, their soul, also dies. Now, there is no indication ever that God is killing them, that God is annihilating them, that God is causing them to not exist anymore. It's just that that human souls, like animal souls, are mortal, and that without the influence of Yahweh's spirit, they simply cease to exist. And we don't know when that happens. Do they go into a state of hibernation for a while, and then collectively those souls that have died estranged from God but not active in leading others astray, whether or not there is a period of awakening and then dismissal? I don't know, but that's God's perspective.
Have you ever heard about past life regression?
I've heard of lots of theories about people thinking that they have been reincarnated and that that they're somehow living out things based upon previous lives. I don't adhere to them, don't agree with them, don't think that they're ever justified or.
But I don't think you did much of any research into it to basically debunk the theory. I mean, I probably know as much as you do about the chemical structure of the brain and how we can be affected by outside source to, you know, mind control and stuff. But there is some unique incidents out there where, you know, little 9-year-old girl comes over and knocks on the door of a 40-50 years old man and tells him, "I'm your wife. And she tells him all about him, all about his dead wife, all about her, and she's also getting mad at him because he got together with some other lady down the street, calling her there's like I don't know. I mean, this I believe in this, and so if I will not get the chance to be with Yahweh in this life, I may choose to come back in another time, maybe in the past, maybe in the future.
Yeah. I don't think there's any possibility that that is correct based upon having come to know Yahweh and his teaching and guidance, Nick. And I understand that there are those who make claims of credibility on behalf of all sorts of odd claims like this. I have never found any credence in any of them.